the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Thursday, March 27th, 8:30 a.m., and we will continue the public testimony portion of the public hearing on House Bill 5016, which is the state school fund portion of the Department of Education budget. I'll open the public hearing, and just to make a few preliminary announcements, if you wish to testify today, on the table over by the door, you'll find a form like this, a witness registration form. Please sign up on it so that we can get you into the loop and testify. We will be taking written testimony over in that area. So if you have written testimony that you'd like the committee members to receive, just give it to our able staffer over there, and it will be distributed to the committee members, and it will also become part of the permanent record of the proceedings today. I am going to ask people to limit their testimony to 3 minutes, and this is a courtesy. We have quite a number of people signed up here today, and only a couple of hours that we are able to have this room and be here to listen. What I'll do that has worked well for me in the past is to call people up in panels, and I'll call a panel up, and I'll also tell people who the next panel will be so you can get ready to testify. If you have written testimony and it's possible for you to summarize your testimony in the interest of saving time and making sure that everyone has an opportunity to testify, I would greatly appreciate that. I would ask you also to please consider that this is a Ways and Means Committee, and the charge of this committee is to write a budget on the revenue that we have to work with. There will doubtless be a revenue discussion surrounding all of the budgets this time, but the revenue discussion will take place in the Revenue Committee, not in the Ways and Means Committee. So I would very much appreciate any suggestions that we could get from you, who are the people that are in the front lines of this issue, about how we can constructively deal with the fiscal situation that we're handed. And with that, I will call forward Jerry Wilson and Julie DeCaro and Jim Scherzinger, if he is present. And after that, I will call forward Susan Massey, Rob Myers, and Roger Lindsley, as they are coming here from long distances. Good morning, and thank you very much for being here with us today. I don't know what order you want to testify in, if you flip the coin in her.
I'd be happy to start. I'm Jerry Wilson, Superintendent of Schools in Hermiston, and you're receiving a copy of my written testimony. What I've tried to show the committee through this testimony is what the effects have been of reductions in Hermiston School District. While I begin with an optimistic picture, it's also a realistic picture from the standpoint of what the quality ed model requires for education. And I wanted to remind the legislative committee about that, because that's the quality world that we would all want to live in. As you can see, I have a series of arrows all pointing downward on the handout that I gave you. With $5.1 billion at the state level to get to $4.9 billion in Hermiston School District, we would use a payment shift, which the legislature enacted in the last special session, as well as end-of-year fund balance, to get to that level in our school district. Beyond that, it will require significant personnel reductions that I've listed to follow to get to $4.7 billion. At the state level, what it will require in Hermiston School District is the reduction of central office personnel, maintenance staff, elementary school personnel, and here we're looking at program specialists, middle school personnel, primarily teachers in the area of physical education, at the high school certified positions, reductions in the area of supplies and equipment, and adding to our participation fees for athletics. To get to the next level, at $4.6 billion at the state level require us to not adopt textbooks, to reduce classroom supplies significantly, to leave only the bare minimum in the buildings to pay for copies and essential office supplies, reductions in maintenance and grounds to all but minimal supplies and equipment. To get to a $4.5 billion level, it will require reducing 6 secondary teaching positions, an assistant principal position, and 5 school days. I present this knowing that our district is in better straits than many. We are a growth district. The primary effect in our district is the increase of class sizes, but it all comes at the time of increasing accountability. And I think that our teachers feel particularly disheartened by that particular fact. When our teachers are required to already buy significant amounts of materials for their classrooms out of their own budgets or out of their own pockets, and you see that what we're doing is needing to cut those supplies even deeper, you can see where our staff would be particularly troubled by that kind of a circumstance. Madam Chairman, you asked about ideas for ways that we might work with this particular problem. I believe that one of the most important ways is that we all recognize and acknowledge the value of public education, the gains that we are making, and that we work from that positive standpoint. In addition, we use that as the means to work for solutions, which inevitably will require additional revenue.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm waiting for it. I'm hoping that Alan Bates can be here when I testify, since he's my representative. I know he had a meeting this morning, so I'm going to.
I'll go next then. Jim Scherzinger, superintendent at Portland Public Schools. And I'd like to start off by saying that I respect the difficulty of the decisions that you have to make here. I worked for this body for a long time, and I'm a lifelong Oregonian, and I understand that these are extraordinary times and in the history of the state, and they are very difficult decisions that you have to make. When I've looked at decisions, and when I've helped legislatures and other decision makers look at decisions in the past, my first question is always, what are the choices? And the first thing that typically you would look at, and I think the chair just suggested, is where can you cut expenditures, where can you get more cost efficient? And I think there's been a lot of talk about this, and some of those places are obvious. Cutting PERS costs by reforming the PERS system is one. Doing something to control the growth of healthcare costs is something that's extremely important to school districts, because personnel costs are 85% of our budget. A third item that I've suggested before, and I hear more people talking about, is doing something to get a statewide student information and finance systems. One of the things that really is extraordinary that I have found in the last few years is that we hired a person out of Pacific Corps to run our IT systems, and he's participated with other IT directors across the state, and they've essentially reached agreement that this is some place we need to go, that we can get more efficient. We can, if we're willing to make the investment, we can get more efficient and reduce our costs by moving to statewide database systems for schools. If there's any place where it's worth it to borrow the money to do this, it's this area, because the savings that we can get from making this investment are extraordinary. And he's putting together some numbers, and I believe that the group is putting together some numbers to show this. I do think, though, that after you go through these particular items, you find that the benefits of these things are limited, that it comes down to one fundamental choice, and that is, if you compare our goals to our tax system, you find a fundamental disconnect. We have set extraordinary goals for education, goals that education have never achieved before. To say that all kids achieve is something that the schools anywhere have not achieved. And there are reasons that this goal has been set, that if if a kid does not achieve to a standard in a modern economy, that kid, that adult, eventually will not participate in the economy to the degree they were able to in the past. There is no place for those kids to go. And that's why we've set that goal and why it's important to the economy to achieve the goal. So we've set a goal for education that we've never achieved. But yet in this state, we have taxes that are extraordinarily low historically. The drop in revenue that we have seen in this state from the current recession is out of all proportion to any drop in revenue that we've seen before compared to the size of the recession. We are now past the drop in revenue that we saw in the early 1980s, even though the recession is nowhere near as deep. And the reason is that we've changed our tax system to be far more volatile and we save no money. Secondly, you're aware of where we are in the tax rankings, and I think if you ask the staff around here, they will tell you that we're about 39th in taxes based on the latest data. Well, that latest data is 2 years old. If you were to take, and what that data will show you is that our state and local taxes as a share of income are 10.5% of income, roughly speaking. If you were to take the most recent data, the most recent actual data that we know in this state, sort of reasonable estimates based on the forecast of personal income that your own staff has done, you would find that our share of taxes has dropped in the last 2 years since the recession began from 10.5% of income to 9.5% of income. That would put us at about 48th, 49th among the 50 states. So our taxes in this state are extraordinarily low. So at the one side of it, we've said that we're going to set extraordinary goals for education. And on the other side of it, we've said we're going to have taxes that are extraordinarily low. Those two just do not fit. It's a fundamental choice that we have to make. And I respect those that are willing to stand up and make the choice one way or another and argue for it. But I think we have to recognize that it is a choice that we make. In Portland, this is the last thing I would say, I think even the business community, has made a different choice. They recognize that having poor schools is bad for the economy. It's hard for them to recruit people to work in the Portland area if schools are underfunded. And they've made the choice, at least we hope they've made the choice, to fund education at a level that helps us compete in a modern economy. I hope that that's the choice that we ultimately make in the state, because I do believe that it's a far better for the state to choose to do this than one local area. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. DeCaro.
Good morning. I'm Julie DeCaro, and I'm the superintendent of Ashland Schools. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today about the level of funding for K-12 in our state. Oregon is recognized as having many national treasures, but I want to present to the committee a national treasure that is sometimes not recognized, and that's the national treasure of K-12 education in the state of Oregon. I think that if you look at our schools and compare them on many, many different levels, you will find that we have, through a series of wise investments and careful planning, invested in our schools in a way that they have able to exceed much better than schools in almost any other state in our country. Although the legislature and the governor have yet to enact a funding recommendation for public schools this year, in Ashland School District, we have been working hard at developing our budget for next year to meet our statutory requirements that we adopt a budget by the end of June. I need to take a budget recommendation to my budget committee in April. And so school boards and superintendents across the state have been working on their budget without knowing the level of funding that the legislature will set for us this year. In Ashland School District, like all districts across the state, we are still reeling from the budget blows that we have received this year. It wasn't until this month, that we had any idea what our actual funding level for this year was. We had to enact a series of budget reduction strategies in response to every cut in revenue, culminating in a 10-day pay cut for all employees. Because of this, my board is justifiably cautious about planning for next year. And we have been working with very conservative estimates as we build our budget for next year. We're using the amount of $4,700 per ADMW, which is just under the amount estimated for Ashland should the legislature enact a $4.5 billion education budget. I want to paint a picture for you of what that amount of funding would look like in a district like Ashland. But first, I need to give you some background on Ashland schools. Ashland is a place where public education works, where the community supports its schools, and where students succeed. In 2000, Ashland, along with Corvallis and Eugene, was named one of the top 100 school districts in the nation. Ashland students consistently perform above state and national norms on measures of academic achievement, and our dropout rate continues to decline, with our most recent measure being a 3.2 percentage rate. Sometimes Ashland is viewed as a wealthy community. However, I serve on the Jackson County Commission of Children and Families, and we recently got a report on the 2000 demographic data from the census. In our county, Ashland and White City have been identified as the two most at-risk communities in our county. We are below our county's mean for income. Three of my schools, Title I schools, are over 50% free and reduced lunch. We have the highest level of single-parent families in the county. And so that even though we certainly do have wealthy people that live in Ashland, we are still being successful with a mixed group of kids who come to school with some with great gifts and others with great deficits. One of the reasons that we are successful is our community is deeply engaged in the life of our schools, and volunteers provide a wide range of support services for our students. However, the quality of our schools is threatened by the continuous drain in revenue. Ashland, like 63% of all other districts in the state of Oregon, is declining in enrollment and is suffering from the dual blow of declining enrollment and revenue. In the 1998-1999 school year, Ashland had a beginning fund balance of over $2 million. This year, we opened the school year with $40,000 in the bank. The Ashland community made the deliberate decision to spend down the reserve to support the quality education going on in our classrooms. Everyone felt sure that the state of Oregon would find a way to adequately fund public schools. Well, we all know that that hasn't happened, and now we must live within the allocations that we receive from the state. For this school year, prior to all the budget cuts that happened during the year, Ashland trimmed $1.9 million from its budget. This meant the elimination of 27 certified positions and 8 classified positions. For the 2003-2004 school year, we are reducing the budget further by another $1.3 million. In 2001-02, we had a $20.5 million budget, and this year we will be just a little over $18 million. This year's staffing will include a reduction of 18 certified and 4.5 classified positions. We truly have reduced our classified support to our schools in such a way that we cannot reduce it any further and keep the doors open. Our class size has increased from an average of 20 in elementary to 25, from 22 in middle schools to 29, from 24 in high schools to 30. In our high school, we've been eliminating our business department, our study skills program, our Japanese program will reduce to one class, and electives will be limited. While we are trying to maintain the team concept that we know what works for our middle school youngsters, we will severely cut the elective programs of PE, music, art, and technology. The only certified support that we're able to give our elementary schools is classroom teachers and one librarian. Everything else has had to be eliminated. Administratively, we have cut our district support services to two positions, the superintendent and the business manager. We do not have a curriculum director, a human resource director, or a facilities manager. All of these tasks must be absorbed by my business manager and myself in order to keep our schools open. We are closing one elementary school this year and have earmarked another one for the next year. And this is what a $4.5 billion in educational funding looks like in schools in Ashland. I urge you to find a way to provide adequate and stable funding for K-12 education. Because of the layoffs of our youngest teachers, we have been unable to invest in the future of our district. Do not be fooled into thinking that we can easily rebuild these, as these teachers are leaving the state in droves. We must find a way to invest in our students now to ensure Oregon's economic viability in the future. I urge you to set a level of funding that is adequate to maintain the quality of our schools and to maintain the national treasure that Oregon schools are. I urge you to work with your colleagues to find additional revenue to support it. Our children are depending on your leadership to ensure their education as future voters and citizens in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you traveling the distances that you did to come and talk to us here today. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since she's my superintendent, I want to at least welcome you to the Capitol.
Thank you.
A four-hour drive and a long, hard one this time of year, and I appreciate your testimony. I would like to reemphasize that out of the thousands and thousands and thousands of school districts in America, three from Oregon in the 2000 survey were picked to be in the top 100, Ashland, Corvallis, and Eugene. And it wasn't because this was an area of high-income kids. This is a diverse population in Ashland, a community that cares about education. And I'm really concerned that we're slowly destroying that system in this state. I think you share that with me, and you know, I talked before you came up here today about this, and I appreciate your testimony. Thank you for coming up, Julie.
Thank you. Chair calls Susan Massey, Rob Myers, and Roger Lindsley, and on deck is Laura Paxton, Janet Hogue, and Carol Robinson. Good morning, Ms. Massey. Could you begin, please?
Good morning. I am Susan Massey. I'm here as Vice Chair of the Quality Education Commission. Also spent almost a decade on the State Board of Education, and I can tell you there probably are few people who care more about what happens to K-12 education in this state than I do. It really grieves me to see all the problems there are, and I fear that as school doors open each morning and as teachers and students go inside, that those of us who believe we know about schools because we've gone to them think that the same things are happening in there that happened when we went. And I think we've heard some pretty specific testimony this morning about the fact that that just isn't true. It isn't true anymore because of several things that have changed, and I believe that we also must change our perspective and how we look at doing business, if you will, in the education system. I'd like to point out to you that I think you've each received a copy of this document. It is the Quality Education Commission report, the work that's been done in the last biennium, and I want to be positive in pointing out that I think this can be a valuable tool to you as you do your work. We can really do database decision making in these times, which is so exciting to me. We have more data than we've ever had about the results that we attain when we spend resources. And so I'm really excited about the work that's going on there. I can tell you that the charge of the commission is to determine the amount of money sufficient to ensure that the system meets the quality goals that are established in our very own statutes. They aren't goals that are made up. They aren't pie-in-the-sky goals. They're set in law by the good people of this state. The commission is to issue a report to the governor and the legislature by August 1st that identifies current practices in the K-12 system, the costs of continuing those practices, and the results that will be obtained in terms of student performance under those practices. Then the commission is to identify best practices for meeting the quality goals, the costs of implementing those best practices, and expected student performance under those best practices. We're also to define a couple of alternatives for meeting the quality goals, and the alternatives in this report show priority for reading in K-12, staff professional development, and high school restructuring. We believe that those are things that would make the biggest difference if we could accomplish them. So the Quality Education Commission is charged to define quality as established in the law and to determine what it will cost to make it possible for those goals to be achieved. It's a tool for data-based decision-making. The imperative on meeting the goals is being strengthened by the federal government now in the name of the No Child Left Behind Act, which you may or may not have heard of. The quality education model, our system of standards and assessments, and the data-based initiative allow the state to align our efforts with that imperative as well, and we're pretty excited about that. We are in a better position than a lot of other states because of the quality work that has gone on already in our system in these areas. The gap between current expenditures and those proposed in the model is considerable, and it's growing. And I know that responsible people charged with doing the job you're doing will be asking why that gap keeps growing. Where does the money go? And I think I can cite at least three reasons why the gap is growing. One is the impact of demographic changes related to special needs of students, including ESL populations. Another is rising costs that school districts can't control, and I don't have to tell you about things like insurance, energy, health care, fuel costs, and PERS. And another reason the gap is growing is that we've never really funded the full model, and so we're in essence getting farther and farther behind. We believe that until our system addresses such issues as overcrowded classrooms, length of school year, and things like textbooks, counselors, and training, student performance will not be as high as it could. The quality education model shows a cause and effect relationship between funding and student success. It provides a roadmap for legislators to use in dissecting the issues and needs to be used to support your budget deliberations. I'd like to close by sharing a quote from Abraham Lincoln. A child is a person who's going to carry on what you have started. He's going to sit where you are sitting, and when you are gone, attend to those things which you think are important. You may adopt all the policies you please, but how they will be carried out depends on him. He will assume control of your cities, states, and nations. He's going to move in and take over your churches, schools, universities, and corporations. All your books are going to be judged or condemned by him. The fate of humanity is in his hands, so it might be well to pay him some attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Myers.
I'm Mr. Myers. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Myers. I live in Condon. I'll talk as quickly as I can to try to get into the three-minute limit. I had several things here that I wanted to say, but I crossed them out, so I'll go to the meat of this. I'm here on behalf of the Frontier Rural Students in Gillum, Sherman, and Wheeler Counties, six school districts there served by the North Central ESD. And also I'm here on behalf of the Rural and Frontier Rural Students served by the school districts and ESDs in Lake Kearney, Grant, and Wallowa Counties. And as a point of reference, that's about 6,500 kids, K-12, spread over 30,000 square miles. I'm not here to restate the problem. I'm not here to whine about money. I'm here because I believe that we, as rural and frontier rural schools, can be a part of the solution rather than the problem. And we can do so based on the premise and the promise that no student in Oregon, regardless of where she or he might live, is more important than another. And that the education of a rural student, even though it may not be equal to an urban student, is equitable within the context of a definition of basic education. And I want to say here, I want to interject real quickly, that we don't see this as an urban versus rural issue. Frankly, we never have. It's been mischaracterized in my mind by unnecessarily inflammatory articles in the Oregonian like rural schools reap urban cash, and by comments like Washington County taxpayers would be outraged if they knew how much money they were sending to rural schools. I don't appreciate that. We have had through our Frontier Learning Network in the North Central ESD a working relationship with Portland Public Schools, thanks to Senator Gordley, to provide elementary Spanish to 3,400 kids throughout the state of Oregon free of charge through their Ola Ola program. When outdoor school was threatened, Judge Pryor from Gillum County called Superintendent Scherzinger and said, if there's anything we can do to help, please let us know. And they weren't idle offers. They weren't hollow gestures. If there's anything we could help, we wanted to know. So I just want to make that very clear, that we never tried to characterize this as an urban versus rural thing. We've been thrust into that position. And having said that, I want to talk real quickly. Condon District 25 in 1990 paid the highest taxes in the state of Oregon for schools. And I think that's important to keep in mind. We know what quality education in Frontier Rural Oregon costs because we wrote the checks. Ballot Measure 5 failed in Gillum County. So the measure, the impacts of Ballot Measure 5 were really forced upon us through no interest of our own. We were willing to pay that money. And I think what we need to look at now is not equalization. And I've never thought that. I think what we need to look at is equity of service delivery. And there's a fundamental difference between equality and equity. A man far smarter than I once said, there's nothing more unfair than the equal treatment of unequals, and that's true. It's absolutely true, and it applies to education in the state of Oregon. In the front of the building, it says on the bottom of the left-hand side, the sharing of benefits justly apportioned. It doesn't say equally apportioned. It says justly apportioned, and this is fundamental to what I want to talk about. It has to do with equitable opportunity for education, not equal, but equitable. And I also want to talk about the idea of entitlement. If we accept the fact that, and frankly, I've always been averse to the idea of entitlement, but I think when we get back to what we're talking about in terms of basic services, are we as citizens and the taxpayers of the state of Oregon entitled to some level of basic service in return for our investment of tax dollars? And I think the answer to that is yes, certainly is in my mind. So the question then becomes, what's the definition of basic? That's the real. That's really what the central question is. What's the definition of basic? And I think that... that we're looking at basic. When I go home every weekend and I look at the kids going to school in Condon or Fossil or Spray or Sherman County or any of the other counties that have remote rural schools, I'm looking at what basic education really is. And to draw a contrast, let me quote Senator Ringo. Senator Ringo said in a commentary not long ago, the state school fund, quote, the state school fund ought to be a floor that provides a funding base sufficient to give every child in every corner of the state a good education, unquote. And I agree with that absolutely. So once again, what we're talking about is what's a good education and what's a funding base sufficient to provide that. If we contrast frontier rural schools and urban schools, the average metro high school in Portland offers 200 courses. The average frontier rural school in our area offers 45. Now, is that fair? I think you could make a case of the fact that it is fair. If in fact we had 200 courses, we don't have the kids to take them. Now, in order to be equal, we'd have to have 200 courses. Equitable is an entirely different approach. Condon can't afford a band teacher. David Douglas offers 12 music courses. David Douglas offers 5 language courses, 1 through 4. Condon High School offers Spanish 1 and 2 to juniors and seniors only. Those are the kinds of things with which we deal. Now, are we going to whine about that being unfair? No, we're not. But I think it's important to understand that we need to make a distinction between equality, once again, and equity, because it's critical, I think, that we do that in terms of how we look at funding. You don't have to create equality, true equality in education. You have to create a sense of equity and then deliver it. Got to get my notes here. And I think one other thing that I want to consider here, that we spent too much time in this building and in this town and maybe other places making decisions based on what are nothing more than statistical aberrations. And I had 3 examples here, but I'll just give you one. In a large metro high school, let's say, for instance, the superintendent makes around $165,000 a year. That's about $3 per ADM. A superintendent of Frontier Rural School makes $75,000 a year, and it's about $900 per ADM. What does that mean? Doesn't mean anything. You have to have a superintendent there. The superintendent of Frontier Rural School is the superintendent, the grade school principal, the high school principal, probably drives bus and coaches a sport or two. But once again, that doesn't matter. That's the way the world works out there. So I want to close on that note, that I think that it's absolutely critical that we look at this in terms of equity and not equality. That's not what we seek. What we seek is a basic level of education to which all students in this state are entitled. And that means different things in different places. Thank you.
Thank you. That is, I think what you've hit on is an issue that we talk a lot about, and it is, I think, succinctly put, the issue of equality of funding on one side and equality of opportunity on the other side. And not an easy issue to get your arms around, but certainly one that we are discussing in this building. Thank you. Your comments are very thoughtful.
Thank you.
Mr. Lindsley.
Hi. My name is Roger Lindsley. I live in Vernonia. For a second there, I thought I was going to follow Abraham Lincoln. I'm not actually associated with anybody. I'm a nonprofits organization grant writer. I'm active in my community. It's a small community of 1,700 people in Columbia County, Northwest Oregon. I had an idea, though, and after looking on the Internet, I realized that it certainly wasn't an original idea, and even in our state, it seems to be widely applied and becoming more widely applied. And that's that in our school, in our town, we use the school buildings and the facilities and the teachers and the textbooks and the computers 3/4 of the year and 3/4 of the day. We have considered a bond measure to build new school buildings in our community. And I think part of the reason why it might have failed has to do with, I've heard it referred to as low taxation, but we're hurting. And it's a factor. When taxes come up for a vote, even if it isn't real, it's perceived, we're uncertain about the future. My idea was that if we used our school facilities and our buildings 100% of the time, and we rotated the students in and out of the school in shifts, that we would be more efficient. And I believe efficiency is something that your committee, your subcommittee, should be focusing on like a laser, because that is the big picture here. How can we make the dollars go further? How can we avoid cuts to delivering our product of education? It's important that we have some sort of consideration of the way that we spend the money that we have. And so far, I haven't heard at the state level consideration of reforming the school year. Our traditional school year was formed maybe in the 30s, a long time ago. And at the time it was formed, it helped families. Families had to can, they had to hay, they had to cut wood, they had to prepare for the winter. And in recognition of that, the school year was altered to provide that long summer vacation. That's not the fact now. What is a fact now is that high school students may be competing with heads of households for summer jobs. That we don't really have a reason to take 13 weeks off in the middle of the year. In addition to being just a very long time off of the learning, and the neurophysiological aspect of learning would, to me, say that that wasn't a good idea. In addition to taking that long time off, you're taking it off during the summer, which in our area is the lowest time for utilities and costs. I think if you do the math, and I put a lot more thought into my written testimony than I'm given to my extemporaneous here, you'll see that we use twice the facility, twice the number of teachers, twice the textbooks to deliver a product to the students that we could do for half of what we do now. Even if you reduce that somewhat, you kept some of the teachers, you would still have some more flexibility in your spending. And I think that's a big picture concept that would be good for this committee to take some action on, to at least study, at least look at the logistics of it, look at the cost savings potential.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony today. Chair calls Laura Paxson, Janet Hogue, and Carol Robinson. And on deck is Lisa Krause, Katie Larsel, and Jim Dufala.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Laura Paxson, and I believe you have written testimony from me there with you. I live in Portland. My sons go to Portland Public Schools, and I teach at Lake Oswego High School. As a parent and a teacher, I have a great personal interest in what comes of these school budget decisions. I have no original solutions, however, to offer you. I am always happy to pay taxes, however. I have voted for every tax increase to support schools, parks, and libraries since I have lived in Oregon. I believe that real national security lies in the health of our public institutions. In lieu of an original solution, however, I'm going to offer you a ground view from a teacher's perspective. It is a story of numbers. My numbers, the student numbers in my classroom this year, are bigger than last year. We had reduction in force last year, lost a member of the department. We'll have reduction in force this year, so my classes will be larger again next year. I teach six classes. My largest class this year has 29 students. My smallest is 21. And although I am approximately at our district ratio of 1 to 26, those numbers don't really tell the real story because it becomes extremely difficult for me to attend to the academic, social, and emotional needs of all these high school students. I know we spend a lot of time and care, well spent, I believe, in protecting small sizes, classroom sizes at the elementary level. However, often in this increasingly complex world we live in, high school students are bottoming out. They are lost in the numbers game due to large class sizes. So numbers. I have close to 170 students under my tutelage this year, 170 names, 170 learning styles, complex individuals I must learn to know. The state of Oregon tells me I must teach my juniors about the Cold War, civil rights, Vietnam, on up to the present day. In addition to these academic requirements, I have to bridge the gap between the high-achieving TAG kids and the students on individual education plans. My charge is to teach freshmen world history. It includes three revolutions, a couple world wars, imperialism, and nationalist movements. Embedded in all this is the assumption that I will make all my students civic-minded and productive. My personal goals are to make history live for my students. I would like them to become lifelong learners and seekers of knowledge in addition to being civic-minded and productive. The best way to do this is to give the kids creative, hands-on projects that require the students to dive headfirst into information and wrestle with it and get dirty with the facts. As my verbs and adjectives perhaps suggest, this is labor-intensive work for both the students and myself. I typically assign enormous projects to be turned in just before the December holidays and the spring break so that I may take the work home and spend about 30 hours correcting it on my holiday. This is the first spring break I've not done that, so I've actually had the time to be a political animal this year. As my written testimony suggests, there is something hidden in the numbers of the governor's budget, and that is the erosion of all that is good in public education. My class sizes, many of them, are already beyond what his proposal suggests. I am looking at 180-plus students for next year. We just lost this year our drug and alcohol counselor. Teachers are academic advisors, coaches, surrogate parents, cheerleaders, confidants, and now counselors as well. And somewhere in between, we actually do teach content material. My district has begun cutting days this year. We will probably be cutting five. For younger teachers, that represents a salary loss of hundreds of dollars. For more experienced teacher, it is close to $1,500. So we are now subsidizing our own profession. It is instructive to remember that the lower living standard income level has been pegged at about $21,000, and beginning first-year teachers earn approximately $27,000. These are the real numbers and the real messages that we send our students. Now, there's the old adage that nobody ever got into education for the money, and that is certainly the case for myself. I am a self-professed history geek and bona fide workaholic. I am, however, a highly qualified history geek and workaholic. I got my bachelor's from Reed College, a master's in history from the University of Oregon, and my teaching certification from Lewis and Clark. I am extremely well-traveled. All of the above expenses were expenses I personally incurred to make myself who I am today. What are we going to tell our children about the expenses we committed collectively to educate them? Please do not break the promise to the next generation. Think of the numbers. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Ms. Ho.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Janet Hogan. I'm the executive director of the Beaverton Education Foundation. I'm here today, though, as a parent and a volunteer. I have two daughters who have attended Beaverton schools. My oldest daughter graduated from Westview High School in 2001, and she now attends the University of Puget Sound. It's no coincidence that she chose to attend an out-of-state private university. Her concerns about the commitment of Oregonians to their higher education system dictated her decision. My youngest daughter is a junior at Westview High School. My children's entire public school careers have been undertaken during the biggest period of disinvestment in the public schools that this state has ever seen. Everyone from the man in the street to the businessman to the political leaders have all declared that education is our top priority. But we have allowed ourselves as voters and decision makers to be confused. We voted in property tax limitations, made decisions on initiatives based on 30-second sound bites, and then we've been surprised when those initiatives have cost us money, whether it's in corrections or salmon recovery. In order to understand what your decisions regarding school funding will do to Beaverton next year, I want to tell you where we are now. Fortunately, Oregon entered a decade of boom economy after the passage of Measure 5, and it partly masked the impacts on the Beaverton School District. But it still wasn't pretty, and during the enormous boom economy of the 90s, Beaverton schools lost money. How were they affected? Between 1993 and 1995, Beaverton School District had to cut $63 million, or one-third of its program and staff at that time. Those reductions have never been recovered. Since 1990, Beaverton School District has grown by 32%, or more than 8,000 students, and opened 10 new schools. And the money to open those schools has come from our operating dollars. Our class sizes, our real class sizes, the number of kids who are actually in a class with the teacher, are close to 30 now at the elementary schools, near 35 at the middle, and near 40 at the high school in the core classes. Every school has lost library aides, music specialists, teachers, counselors, administrators, course offerings, and electives. We used to have elementary band and orchestra. Our high school students pay a participation fee or an activity fee of between $75 or $150 per sport or activity, drama, choir, band. We used to offer multiple foreign languages at every middle school, and now even in this global economy, our students are offered whatever one language the foreign language teacher speaks. This hasn't been a controlled experiment. We can't take my oldest daughter's graduating class of 2001 and have them repeat their educations. Kelly never had an art class. She only began taking foreign language in high school. It wasn't offered in her middle school. Would she and her classmates be different people if they could repeat their educations with some of these lost opportunities? Is there a violinist out there, an artist, an athlete, who because of budget reductions and lack of opportunity has never blossomed? What are the chances that one of our high school counselors knows each of his 500 students right now? How does one of Beaverton School District's 13 remaining nurses reach 35,000 students? Over the past 2 years, Beaverton School District has had to cut another $40 million, raising class sizes and eliminating programs again. It is one of only two metro school districts that have not had to cut days this spring, but only because it has depleted carefully saved reserves during a decade of responsible fiscal management. Beaverton's administrative costs are the lowest among the 10 largest Oregon districts, along with Gresham-Barlow. Administrators comprise just 4% of total staff. The district has reduced central administrative support, instructional support, and business office support by 40%. Beaverton capped medical insurance for employees to hold down health care costs and retain teachers. Beaverton has implemented extensive energy cost savings measures. But based on funding levels that you've been discussing at 4.5 and 4.6, Beaverton is planning on budget reductions of $30 to $35 million for next year. There are no reserves left. We had to use those to keep this year intact. The Budget Committee has identified staff and program reductions that include 5 fewer school days, elimination of extracurricular activities including high school sports, 250 fewer teachers including the elimination of all elementary PE and music teachers, all librarians at elementary and middle schools, and middle school reading specialists, reduction of counselors at the middle school level, reduction of attendance clerks and campus monitors at the high school levels, and reduction of administrators and classified staff across the board. The loss of 250 teachers will result in class sizes, real class sizes, of over 30 in the elementary schools, 40 and above in the middle schools, and close to 50 in high school core classes. I'm not making these numbers up. This committee wants information so they can develop tools to help teachers deal with higher class sizes, fewer course offerings, and less instructional time. I'm here to tell you there are no tools available to deal with this. I cannot give you any assurances or assuage any guilt that you might have that public education and life as we know it will be able to continue at these funding levels. I'm here to give you a picture of what those funding levels mean. Our school systems in our state are unraveling. Our school years are shortening, and as school years are shortening, class sizes increase again, it will be impossible to attract the best and brightest teachers to Oregon's ranks. Our students cannot be successful if they are not in school. There are no tools that can fix that. 2 weeks ago, one of our middle school principals wrote 9 letters of recommendation for teachers from his staff who were on the chopping blocks and applying for jobs outside of Oregon. His beleaguered counselors can't keep up with transcript requests for students applying to middle schools. And all over Washington County, the economic engine of this state, for sale signs are blooming in spring lawns as families with young children look to move elsewhere. Oregon has simply not made the commitment to adequately fund its schools or any of its state services. We aren't having the right conversations in Oregon. And as Superintendent Scherzinger pointed out, during the boom years of the 90s, we gave tax breaks instead of saving for a rainy day. We have an incredibly unbalanced tax system, and our tax rate rates us at one of the bottom in the nation. Our Citizens Initiative has paralyzed our state, and the state constitution has been amended with the flick of a chad. Initiatives have qualified for the ballot that don't have revenue packages attached to fund them that have been unconstitutional. Entire legislative sessions have been spent dealing and cleaning up and rewriting poorly written initiatives. Because of all these factors, there's simply not enough money in the state budget to pay for the services that Oregon needs and that Oregonians want. And I don't understand why this is difficult to understand. Expert economists from around the country are lowering our bond rating because of the way we're running our state government. It's impossible to continually cut taxes and imply that the level of services will not be affected. We haven't had the conversation of what services Oregonians want and what they want to pay for.
You've been speaking for more than 10 minutes now, so in the interest of the rest of the people that are signed up to speak, could you possibly wind your comments up?
I don't think it's been quite 10 minutes, but we have to assume that if we're going to live in a state that these current funding levels and at these revenue levels that this is the kind of system we're going to have. So if we do not want to do that, we're going to have to generate more revenue. We're going to have to modify our tax structure, and we're going to have to deal with ways of generating more money. It's time to remember that we're all connected and that every child and person has value. It's time to do what is right and not what is politically expedient in our state. So I'm encouraging you to look at what we need to do if we want to have healthy communities with strong schools generating a strong economy. We're going to have to pay for them, and we're going to have to look at ways to generate revenue.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your comments. Ms. Robinson.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Carol Robinson, and I'm here today speaking for the Coalition for School Funding Now. I represent hundreds of parents, business leaders, and community members who believe that the goal of stable and adequate funding for our public K-12 schools should be more than a campaign slogan and way more than a pipe dream. And that's the way it's looking today. We believe that this committee and ultimately The legislature has the responsibility to the students in Oregon to provide a quality education, not just a minimum education. To help make sure that each child educated in Oregon is prepared to be successful in college or the workforce, schools must be able to provide an environment that includes the following, and we will call these our success predictors. They are a stable school year, reasonable class sizes, a principal with the skills to be an effective leader of staff, parents, and students, highly qualified teachers who are fairly compensated for their important work, and the opportunity for students to be exposed on a regular basis to the important components of a comprehensive education, including art, music, and physical education. The level of funding currently under consideration will threaten all of these success predictors and ultimately compromise the success of students around the state. And I'm going to say that again. The level of funding that you are currently considering will compromise success of students in this state. You have heard from superintendents that many districts have been creating their budget plans from the governor's original budget. The shock of a potential $4.6 billion budget has not even set in with school districts, and the impact of the direct educational cuts to balance their budget at that funding level has not yet been addressed. So you've only begun to hear the stories. And I encourage you as a committee to schedule additional time for having public testimony from some of these other districts. During spring break is not necessarily the best time for students, educators, and parents to be able to communicate this message to you. The additional cuts that would result from a funding level lower than the governor's budget will be far more drastic. The low-hanging fruit of budget cuts was picked years ago, and there is simply no way to protect children from the impact of these reductions. No tools, no moving things to other burners will save children from these significant impacts. Nothing, in fact, you can do will make these reductions more palatable to children in Oregon. Scholarship and college acceptance rates will be jeopardized. Dropout rates will rise with the reduction of high school options. And frankly, as you have heard, the parents who can leave the system will begin to. Companies will not be attracted to locate in this state where we provide the shortest school year in the nation and next, some of the highest class sizes. Quality employees will begin to leave for better opportunities for their children. And I just sit imagining our governor's conversations with the biotech companies that we say we aspire to attract to Oregon. Hey, we've got a lot to offer here in Oregon, unless, of course, you happen to be a child or have children. Of course, you know, he could offer to show them around some of the bowling alleys to spend their days off in. But even the governor's budget would not be a cakewalk for school districts, as you have heard last night. The assumed wage and benefit freezes in the governor's budget must be examined for practical implementation by school districts. Please be very aware of these difficult positions that this puts school boards and school employees in when most districts have existing labor contracts in place. Reopening these contract negotiations in the face of budget shortfalls is not a slam dunk for districts and is not necessarily even in the scope of good labor practice. At a time when schools are dealing with the stressful effects of this economic recession, both with their own budgets and with the budgets of the families they serve, staff and management need to have both of their oars in the water rowing together, working together. The potential for divisive strife that wage freezes could bring will be weighed by school districts individually, and you as legislators must be aware of this difficult reality. Furthermore, the governor's budget assumes a 0% increase in other school district costs. Well, I maintain this is voodoo budgeting. Gasoline costs more for our cars, but not for school buses. Paper and ink cartridges, cleaning supplies, and electricities are just a few of the costs that will go up both in our homes and in schools. And schools have been pinching pennies for more than a decade, lowering the thermostat, limiting the use of papers and supplies. So the idea that children should wear mittens and use an erasable slate to hold down energy and paper costs might seem a little extreme, but that's the direction we're going here in Oregon, 2003. Let's be real. These increasing costs will be paid for by cutting additional programs and staff. There are areas, however, of cost containment that would be very helpful to school districts in Oregon.
If I could interject.
I'm here representing hundreds of parents.
I understand that, but I am the chair of the committee.
I understand that, Madam Chair. Thank you. I will be wrapping this up.
Please. You have now been speaking for 8 minutes. You're 8 minutes into a 3-minute time slot. There are people lined up behind you. We have your written testimony in front of us.
Thank you. I will conclude my testimony.
Your testimony.
Thank you. I will do that because it is important to acknowledge the efforts that the legislature is making to help school districts with some of their spiraling costs. The Coalition for School Funding now has recommended that PERS and health care cost containment strategies are part of our legislative agenda. And we applaud the moves by this legislature to help school districts with these issues. We do. But these efforts must be made while keeping an eye on the list of success predictors at the beginning of my testimony, because we can't expect the best and brightest teachers to remain in Oregon in the face of drastic layoffs and wage and benefit reductions. A balance must be reached. While this committee may not be able to pass out revenue options, you are a voting member of the legislature, and you could each go back to your caucuses and say, I can't vote for this level of funding for Oregon school children. We must raise revenue to do our job responsibly. So we ask that you do that. The Coalition for School Funding now understands it's difficult, but we ask you to make the investment at a responsible level, providing funds for a quality education for all of Oregon's children. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Chair calls Lisa Krause, Katie Marshall, and Jim DeFalla. Ms. Krause.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing public testimony. My name is Lisa Krause. I live in Corvallis, where I chair the Corvallis Education Coalition. I'm the mother of three school-aged children. My youngest is a kindergartner this year. I'm currently a substitute teacher for the Corvallis School District. My job teaching a second language was cut this past year. So I come before you as a parent and as someone profoundly connected and personally connected to an Oregon educational system in decay, a system that has even been the object of national ridicule. Let me begin with my role as a substitute teacher and as a colleague to my many friends who are struggling in this profession. I substituted for a high school math teacher one day last fall. He had 213 students that day, and he was expecting an additional three before the day was over. Several of his classes are for students who were in the lower level math class and very clearly needed a lot of individual attention. The room was overcrowded, elbows touching elbows, feet touching feet, and no room for walking in the aisles. This teacher was swamped with corrections. If he requested a mere three assignments per student, that would give him over 600 corrections per week. And teachers regularly asked for revised corrections. That puts him over the 700 corrections per week level. After this, he somehow has to record those scores. It's a good thing he was so organized. In the end, though, during second semester, he asked to reduce his teaching load by one block, and of course that meant dropping his full-time employment and his paycheck as well. My neighbor is a nationally recognized science teacher. Several years ago, after having taught some 30 years, he asked to drop his full-time employment to a 0.83. He felt he was not serving his students as well in the as he had done in the past. He simply could not keep up with the additional workloads coming in from every angle. This is a master teacher with years of experience. He dropped one class. He's paid less, but he tells me he still has more work now than he had 10 years ago. I substituted in a middle school PE class. If you don't think having 41 middle school age boys and girls in one class isn't a safety issue, you probably haven't spent any time with 41 middle school age boys and girls in a gym before. We are asking PE teachers to be in three different places at one time, monitoring in the hallway, monitoring in the locker rooms, and monitoring activities in the gym as well. I have further stories about what I see as a substitute, but I'm going to turn my attention to my role as a parent. My daughter is an eighth grader and my son is a sixth grader. Their classes are getting larger and larger each year. I ask, what is the limit? For my daughter, there are roughly 40 kids in both her math and her tag humanities classes. What is the limit? Beyond the question of what is appropriate in a scholastic sense, are we even meeting the fire codes with that many kids in a classroom? It's nearly impossible for teachers to circulate in these classrooms because the students are packed in so tightly. What is the limit? My youngest child is a kindergartner. There are 25 children in his class. When is the last time you spent a full day with 25 5- and 6-year-olds? His teacher is incredible. But why is she working until 5 and 6 in the evening and on weekends and over spring break? How many children is an acceptable number for kindergarten? Is it 30? What is the limit? My children lost 7 days of school this year so that the district could balance its budget. I am distressed that the budget is being balanced on the backs of my children. They will be in school for 165 days this year, and it looks even worse next year. What happened to 185 days? The message of 165 days is that we are hoping at best to prepare our children to be unskilled workers. 165 days a year is not appropriately educating our children. Will that be 160 days next year? Will it be 155? What's the limit? Our children are out there selling chocolates, magazines, books, CDs, popcorns, cookies, Krispy Kremes, Christmas wrapping paper, Christmas wreaths, and a whole host of other things. Parents and their children are holding garage sales, bake sales, jogathons, and sock hops, all to fund sound academic projects for their schools, projects that an appropriate budget should easily provide for. Is inappropriate underfunding for our schools an emotional topic for me? I would be ashamed if it were not. We need changes now so that our children hear the message from Oregon that this state values a sound education for its students.
Summarize your
testimony, my last line.
Please.
We need appropriate funding now. $5.2 billion is still a bare cupboard. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Larsell.
Yes, my name is Katie Larsell, and I'm a parent in the Park Rose School District. I'm also a board member. You've been hearing a lot of numbers, but I wanted to start just to tell a couple of short stories that illustrate some of the things that are happening.
Could you possibly lean further into the microphone?
Okay, you can't hear me. I want to tell you about driving by some neighbors and seeing a for sale sign on their house. These are real people, but I'm going to use a different name, John and Jill Conroy. If you went to the middle school, Park Rose Middle School, and you asked who was the premier volunteer there, it would be Jill Conroy. When I needed someone of unimpeachable character to be the treasurer for our levy campaign, I went to John Conroy and asked him, and he was happy to help, even though he works a full-time job. They're the premier, I would say, the people that do the volunteer work, and everyone in the community knows them. They have a for sale sign in their house. Is it because of the Park Rose school system? I was afraid of that, but I finally did ask them, why are you guys moving? And it really is bigger than that. They have looked at the state of Oregon and said that it's not investing in the things that they like. In Park Rose, we're just a hop skip across to Washington. So they're moving. They're taking, this is a professional man, they're taking their tax dollars with them. I think that that's a story that is not the big picture, but it's indicative of what is happening all around the state, and probably a lot more where there's, when you're close to the boundaries with another state. And he says to me, in Vancouver they haven't lost a bond measure in 10 years. I don't know if that's true, but that's the reason that they're leaving. The other story I wanted to share with you is that recently there's been a lot of pain in the city of Portland. Now, Park Rose is in the city of Portland, but it's a separate school district, a small school district that is right next to the Portland School District. Well, the Portland School District recently did the massive cuts that next year everyone is going to have to do. And until they made those cuts, until those announcements were made, the amount of political pain or the amount of activism that you would find out there was just not that high. But when that happened, the activism went skyrocketing. And I would notice I go into the city to visit my friends, suddenly that's all they could talk about. And with the kinds of things that you're proposing, I'm actually hoping that if these kinds of numbers that you're proposing are implemented, the rest of the state of Oregon will rise up. I don't think people do it until the axe actually falls. But as you noticed that in Multnomah County and the city of Portland, there's been a huge movement to rescue the schools. And that's come because the cuts were actually there. People didn't respond until they actually saw the cuts being implemented, and then it was like, wake up, okay, this is not acceptable. I think that will happen. I'm hoping that will happen if these cuts are put in. As far as the numbers go for Park Rose, we have been cutting for 12 years now. Our class sizes are fairly high because we've cut all of the fat quite a while ago. Our class sizes are in the elementary schools up around 29, middle schools 34, high school 34. If any of you would like to come and visit our middle school, it is dramatic there. If you can imagine that kind of energy boxed into rooms with 35 kids in it. And it's almost unbelievable. And so every time the funding goes down, 5.05, and please stop me if I'm talking too long.
I was going to ask you if you would please summarize your testimony.
Okay, I was just going to say that at 5.5, 1.7 million less than last year's adopted budget. It's 2 million more than we spent this year, but we had to cut 6 days and we had to cut many other things that we could do as a one-time deferrals. At 4.8, we're down 0.8 million. That translates directly into about 10 teachers. 4.5 at that budget level, 1.7 million, 23 teachers. And I mean, it starts getting ridiculous. At 4.2, it's 33 teachers, but we only have 131. So I'm not exactly sure how that would work.
Thank you very much. Mr. DeFalla.
DeFalla, yes. Good morning. My name is Jim DeFalla, and I'm the parent of an 8-year-old son in Gresham, and I'm responding to ways to work with scant resources. The educational system is broken, and we should wipe the table clean and start over. These are not my words. Would it surprise you to learn that this is a quote certainly set off the record from an ODE staff person who has an office just across the lawn? I'm not suggesting that we blow up the system, but it's very fair to say that far too many Oregonians question the end product, the education our children receive. I and most of my friends who have children in public education voted against Measure 28 recently because we want to fund kids, not the system commonly referred to as schools. Spending most of the school year learning to take a test has not made my son any smarter. Let me say this very clearly. As a man of very modest income, I would gladly give my son's teacher $1,000 for use in the classroom than to give one more penny to schools. I have repeatedly asked school board members and school administrators if they had all the money requested, how much difference that would make in my son's classroom. Well, I have yet to get even a response. Perhaps you could get some straight answers. I'm one of a growing number of Oregonians who believes that our scant resources, if used wisely, can fund a world-class education for our children. After all, education boils down to a relationship between teacher and students. Our scant resources can easily be leveraged if the so-called system allowed for real parent participation. Remember that parents are business owners, parents are skilled professionals, parents are community leaders, and parents are even teachers. There really is no reason why parents can't be part of the solution. And yet the system does not make any provisions for real parent participation. As a matter of fact, teachers tell me that they are taught in college to even keep parents at arm's length. I, for one, have been continually rebuffed by school administrators in my efforts to volunteer at my son's school. As a matter of fact, over the past 5 years, I have contacted over 20 districts with the same results. So just what would my $1,000 buy? I could provide my son's entire third grade classroom with year-long supplies and parent volunteers to teach robotics and set up a hydroponics garden, all to be aligned with a certificate of advanced mastery, and still have money left over for field trips, T-shirts, and pizza for the kids. That's about $35 a year per student. But the discouragement of parent participation is much bigger than myself. 5 years ago, I was part of a contingent led by Intel that was told by, I forget the name of the organization here, that parents have no place in public education. And I know I'm going to just kind of conclude by saying I want to get off my soapbox. And my purpose is to come in here is to present a solution. I have lots of ideas of how to improve education and so-called scant resources, but so do many people. But instead of listing each idea, I would like to propose that you help me to form an entity operating within structure of the ODE, but staffed entirely by non-educators, whereby parents are empowered to have real input into our children's education. And I don't mean fundraising and stuffing envelopes, which is commonly the functions of PTAs and other parent groups. The vision is for the entity to be the window for the community at large to which to make real differences in the education our children receive. Basically, we would disseminate suggestions and proposals and have the power to create classroom models for better educating our children that can be easily replicated in Oregon schools. The fact is, good models like Canby's AGBE program that engages all types of learners are badly lacking in Oregon. Recognizing that there are scant resources, I am led to believe that the public sector would welcome the challenge of funding such an entity if you were to recognize it. As a parent advocating for my son and all Oregon children, I am seeking your assistance in taking the appropriate next step to create an entity that would speak on behalf of parents, students, and community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all of your testimonies. Chair calls Lynn Lundquist, David Meredith, and Catherine Arnold. And on deck is Dr. Lon Robertson. And I believe there's another name. Mr. Lundquist.
Thank you, Chairman Morgan. First of all, I appreciate the opportunity you availed to the public to come and testify. As you know, I've sat in your position, and it takes a lot of stick-to-itiveness to sit up there hour after hour, but I appreciate yours and the rest of the committee as well. Chairman Morgan, you have asked, what can K-12 do so as to have the same outcomes with significant less resources? And I think that's a very challenging question and one that's hard to stay on course with, if you will. Last night, for those who are here, remember that a couple of the testifiers said that we can't run our schools like a business, and in some ways that's certainly true. But since I'm representing the Oregon Business Association, which is businesses across the state, I'd like to take just a moment here and examine some business principles. Now, I realize this isn't a business committee. However, if you'll bear with me a little bit, I'll make the connection as I hope will be successful. The first,
and I hope you can do it quickly.
And I'll try to do it as quickly as I possibly can. If you'll give me a little heads up so I can try to summarize if I get here. The first principle is this. Direct correlation between quality and quantity of output and quality and quantity of input. There's that correlation. Is it a one-to-one correlation? No, but it certainly approaches that in most business enterprises. Second, its productivity is increased by improving competency of the employees. Third principle. Decreases in quality of output almost universally decrease profitability of a company. The fourth principle, it is much less costly to retain present customers than it is to try to secure new customers. And the fifth principle, it is much more costly to have every unit meet a minimum standard rather than having an average meet the standard. Let me relate that then to K-12 here, if I might. The first one, in correlating quantity of input and quality of output. No matter how much we would like to say it's not true, it is true that by reducing teachers, counselors, and our offerings, we will reduce the quality of our graduates, and dropouts will increase. The second principle, increasing productivity by competency of employees. As we expend less money in the K-12 system, it is just logical that money will be taken away from professional development, and the QEM speak very highly that that is an essential ingredient. So as we decrease resources, we're going to decrease the competency of our employees. Third one, decreasing quality of output decreases profitability. I think that's a very key point here. When students receive a lower quality education, Oregon simply will have a less return on their investment. As good senator from Coos Bay would attest to, when the quality goes down, the profitability goes by the window very quickly. And sometimes total revenue, let's not get hung up on the fact that you can decrease revenue, total revenue, maybe not significantly by decreasing prices, as a good senator from Coos Bay can relate to, yet on the profitable side, it is a huge increase. So even a 10% reduction of the K-12 system will have significant reductions in the profitability, and I relate profitability to quality here. The fourth principle of keeping present customers, let's just take Portland, for example, and last night you heard, when people move to Washington, move to other places, we will not bring them back to our system. And as someone from Central Oregon, I care a great deal about what happens in Portland or urban, because if that goes down and those people leave, the middle-income people leave our cities, you and I will be impacted that negatively in Central Oregon or any place else. And the fifth principle about the standard for every individual, let me relate that because he may not understand exactly what I'm saying here. As agriculturists, we think that when we have average production out of a field of wheat, that we meet our goal. But if we had to meet every acre to meet that standard, it would be significantly more expensive. And that's what we're asking our students to do. That's what we're asking our K-12 system to do. It's not an average test score for all the students in the system. It's for every single student. I think that's right. But I think it's costly. Let me finish up by giving a challenge to the committee and to the business community as well. If I can get the right sheet here so that I... The challenge is this. Madam Chairman, you have said that this is the Ways and Means Committee, and rightfully so, and the revenue does not start here. But let me challenge you to this. I think it's your responsibility to say, is the 4.6 a good figure, a sufficient figure? If it is, I encourage you to take the offensive to your colleagues and to Oregonians and say, that's the right figure for K-12 education, based on all the testimony you've heard. If, in fact, that's not the right figure, I challenge you to take your colleagues and go to the Revenue Committee and say, then we need additional resources. I also challenge the business community because we have to step up as well. We accept that challenge. If we think that's the right figure, we're going to go out to the public and say that's right. If we think it's not the right figure, we're going to say we need more revenue. OBA, I can't talk to the total business community, but I can tell you on a stack of Bibles as high as anyone would like to stack, OBA accepts that challenge. Because we will be here, and if you need our help in reaching whatever goal that you're going to set, I hope that you will avail yourself of that opportunity. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much. Mr. Meredith.
Madam Chair and subcommittee members, my name is David Meredith. I am the father of two recent graduates of Eugene School District 4J. During their school years, I volunteered a great deal, and my biggest impression is that Oregon students want to dream big dreams. And it really is a pleasure to help them do so, but there are challenges. My cousin Katie is a seventh grader who wanted to do her homework in biology, but he told her dad there was no book. There was a book in every desk in the room, but it had to stay there because the books were shared with two other classes. Then my friend Clay went to Spanish class, and if he's not there early on, he has to sit on the windowsill. There are no seats left. As staffing goes down, class sizes go up, and it's hard to get much Spanish done with 40 students. You've heard stories like this before, but I did drive in today, so you could add one more mark to the tally of people who came, in case your colleagues ask, and also to say thank you for your continuing work to ensure our students can dream big dreams. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Arnold.
My name is Catherine Arnold. I'm a mother of three children in the Beaverton School District. I've been involved, you know, hands-on teaching art literacy and helping in classrooms with reading and, you know, other whatever is needed with the students since my son started. So that's been like 8 years now. And I've watched over the 8 years, every year we go through this, how can we do more with less? How can we do more with less? And, you know, you've heard this all before, and I think the gentlemen here have really summed it up pretty well, what I would say, but there's nothing more to do. You guys are being asked to do something that's really not possible in order to provide a product that will really educate our children. Just one thing I'd like to say, and I've heard this all before, I've also helped in our local government, and I just finished serving on the Social Service Funding Committee, where we fund nonprofits, and one of them was a group called Youth Contact, who tries to help, you know, teens at the margin. And basically what they're saying is, you can't get a job anymore if you don't have at least a GED, and even that's not enough. We've seen a huge requirement in what it takes to get jobs and to be productive and successful in this society. And if we don't provide the opportunity for children to get that in schools, we are just on a sinking ship. We can pay now or pay later. And as also was said, I really admire you for the job you do. This is a tremendous thing to have to do, and I know you do it from your hearts. You're definitely, you know, the advantage as far as prestige or money is not there. So I really commend you for what you're trying to do, and I really feel like you're being asked to do something again that you really can't do, and I hate to say that that's the message that I think you should take back, but that's the message I think you should take back. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair calls Dr. Lon Robertson and Steve Schott, and up on deck is the OEA, the OSBA, and COSA. Dr. Robertson, thank you for joining us, and I'm appreciate your patience.
Well, it's nice to be away from my patients every once in a while to be here. Madam Chair and subcommittee members, thank you very much for this opportunity. And as other people have suggested, I do appreciate your ability as well as your willingness to sit here for the many hours that you have to hear the testimony. I feel privileged to be in this room today, a room full of passionate people that are passionate about kids and education, and I know you all are too, because you could not endure this in any other way. I sat here somewhat bemused by testimony talking about strong schools, best practices, quality education, 21st century schools, and sound academics. Those are just some sound bites I heard while I sat here. And I came to thinking something totally different. I represent the Crestwell School District. I'm on the school board there, and I represent two very valuable members of that Crestwell School District, my son and daughter in high school. And we're facing nothing that resembles strong schools, best practices, quality education, 21st century schools. That's probably the biggest joke. Or nor sound academics. I'm no longer angry. I'm not at the point of raising my voice or hollering. I feel like I'm a member of the crew on the Titanic as it split apart and is going down. There's no energy left to be angry. We're here as desperate people. We are looking at right now staff reductions at our high school from 23 teachers to 11 teachers next year. That is the cut. That'll be a 41 student per teacher ratio, all electives cut, every single elective, including calculus and physics. At our elementary school, 46 students per classroom, no aides, in classrooms that were built for 26 to 27 students, as most elementary schools are. So we're looking right now at ways, how can we move those students into the gymnasium, into the cafeteria, and try to teach them, because we physically can't put them in our classrooms. I know you don't want to hear about whining and talking about funding, but it can't happen. We are pretending to provide an education at Creswell for next year. It's no longer how are we going to do it? How are we going to do more with less? We're really at the point of how can we do anything? And my personal feeling is we might be better to not open the schools next year, because I really believe we're sending the wrong message. With those ratios, those are unfortunately realistic ones. I've got the documents with me. What are we saying? You know, parents don't understand. Many parents don't understand. They think that their kids are getting an education, but at those levels, they're not. We will not be able to offer the courses required for graduation at Creswell High School next year. We know that. We cannot offer Spanish. We can't offer a second language. So even if you can go out to Lane Community College and get the required courses to graduate, you'll have to take additional courses because you can't go into the university system in Oregon without a second language. This is a desperate time, and I very much appreciate your patience and willingness to serve on this committee, but I do think that you are simply dealing with an impossible task, and you need to go back to the legislature and let them know that I don't know how you do it. I don't know how I can serve my constituency as I sit there and tell them what I have to tell them next week at the community-wide forum to explain what's going to happen. I envy the teacher from Beaverton who is worried about people moving out of the district. I can assure her I know where they will not be moving if they're looking for an education for their children. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Schopp.
Representative Morgan, rest of the representatives, my name is Steve Schopp. I'm a parent, school advocate, public school system advocate, and an amateur analyst, for lack of a better classification. I've spent a good 4 years looking through the public education system and much of the, presentation coming from the Oregon Department of Education, the Confederation of School Administrators, Oregon School Board Association, and such. And I would submit to you that I would urge you to completely and totally disregard and reject all testimony coming from all those organizations. The Oregon Department of Education, and along with the rest of these organizations, have to this date, especially in light of the last few months, have misrepresented issue after issue regarding Oregon public school system relative to the Oregon School Board Association. On their website, it reads in a graph, Oregon again ranks second in nation in SAT scores. We're 25th. This continual misrepresentation by these people most entrusted with our public school system must stop. And it has to come from ways and means and some mechanism here and some body that provides legitimate and genuine oversight. The Oregon report card, I'm sure you're all familiar with it. You're at least aware of it. Is it not supposed to be a reliable tool for some purpose? If not just for parents or maybe people moving in this state, this is something that they're touting as reliable, that's useful, that this is a great thing. Let me give you an example of how you can no longer trust these people. In this particular district, where it says local information right here, and right next to it is a breakdown of the different variety of academic measurements, SAT scores and such. In the first sentence, it says, Sherwood High School students improved in every academic category on the 2002 report card. That's pretty simple. I'm not nitpicking here. That's a glaring statement. Every academic area they've improved. Right next to there is the SAT scores. They tell you this year's or 2002's numbers, but the matter of fact is their scores went down 21 points just that year. They also went down the year before. And if you look across the board, whether it's NAEP and SAT scores as the average in the state of Oregon, and dissecting through different districts, and comparing to the national average, you'll see a shift in the trend of student performance that should be a huge red flag. That shift is what has done is changed the path of student performance, where in the not-too-distant future, it's going to cross the path of the national average, and we will there be below the national average. It's unarguable. the recent study done by university economics professor regarding the dumbing down of the assessments is staggering. And yet the people most entrusted with our education system, again, the Confederation of School Administrators, the Oregon School Board Association, the Oregon Department of Education, the Oregon Education Association, and indeed the Oregon Business Council and others, have continually misrepresented issues in our public education system, and it's got to stop. When we look at different testimonies coming about the, you know, as you're well aware, there's a bill to abolish Sim and Cam. Continually, a straw man argument is being made to sustain this failed program. Every single body of evidence is gathered by me, by people like me, with no pay, using my spare time, analyzing and submitting on the record information is completely ignored. You can't get these people to take the time of their, for instance, the 500 people that work at the Oregon Department of Education. How many of them are auditing their operation? None. They say they can't afford to provide auditing, inside auditing, but they have all these other efforts going on. I'm sure you've been to the Oregon Department of Education website. If you haven't, I urge you to visit there and see how many how much effort takes place down there. And again, you're looking at funding our education system. And to wrap up here, and I know there might be others, I would urge you to look around maybe some other states. And what you'll find, like I did when I researched Michigan, for instance, they had the same arguments going on. They had the same groups, the same usual suspects, clamoring on about we need more funding, while they proceeded to undermine the education system through their failed programs. And currently, places like Grand Rapids, when I was there 2 years ago, were in the process of closing.
Shaw, in the interest of time, if you could recap your testimony
okay.
to close.
I sure will. I'll be just 30 seconds. And what they're doing there in that particular district is closing a dozen schools at a time because they're being taken over by charter schools. This is what's in the future for Oregon unless we can completely reshape our public school system and get some reliable and honest people in there crafting policy.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming here today. Chair calls a panel of the OEA, OSBA, and COSA.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And on behalf of public education in Oregon, I'd like to thank you for the courtesy and the time you've given to this important issue. I know how difficult it is to hear the pleas, but it's appreciated. As I was driving home last night and on the way in this morning, I was thinking about what I might say to you. I certainly can't provide the compelling testimony that you've heard over the past couple days. But I was thinking about the people that I represent and the what they share with you. These folks campaigned and were elected to public office, just like you. They did that for various motivations. Some wanted to deal with a single issue. Some wanted to give back something to their community. Some wanted to make a difference. But all, I think, did so to make some level of a commitment. They all come from various walks of life. They're men and women. They're different colors, different ethnicity. And like your meeting last night, they're holding dozens of meetings around the state, sitting in similar rooms to this, although maybe perhaps not as palatial. And certainly when a board meets in the middle school cafeteria, the chairs might be a little bit smaller and more uncomfortable. But they listen to similar stories. And in making their budget decisions, they will hear from parents and members of the community and students and staff about the impact of the budget that they're forced to balance. And the response that those folks testifying before those local school board meetings, I'm certain, are very similar to the responses that many of the people heard from you last night and this morning, that you have to make tough decisions. There's no money. And the conclusions, I think, that they drew were probably similar, that those with the greatest need will suffer the most. And I think the tragedy of the decisions that you'll be forced to make and my members in those local meetings will be forced to make is the fact that the kids that have strong parental support, that will probably do okay. And it's those kids on the margin that I think will suffer the most. The next percent to getting the kids to reading standards will suffer. The kids that are in danger of falling through the cracks most likely will. And I understand, Madam Chair, very clearly the purview of your committee. Your charge is to balance a budget within your available resources. But I've also been around this building a long time, and I've heard from this committee that we'll spend the money we have, and a committee that meets down at the other end of the building, they will say we'll raise the money we need. And I'm hopeful that at some point in this process, the two ends of the building will meet in the middle. And I was thinking that of the 90 of you representing the interests of over 2 million Oregonians and ultimately the interests of 550,000 school kids, 47 of you will ultimately decide. 47 out of over 2 million. It rests in your hands. And if you think about revenue, 54. Madam Chair, you ask about tools to help us, and I've got some ideas. Tools implies a toolkit and maybe a screwdriver or a wrench or a hammer that you might use for a minor fix-up job. And I would submit that what we need is major earth-moving equipment. Sim and Cam, there were those that suggested if we could get rid of Sim and Cam, we could save schools $500 million. The COSA survey and the survey from the Department of Education suggested the savings would amount to less than one-tenth of that amount. The standards we have and the assessment of those standards is embedded in what we do. And that's like suggesting to United Airlines that they could save money and avoid bankruptcy by not taking so many passengers where they want to go. Mandates. There's been the suggestion that there's some silver bullet, that if mandates could only be eliminated, then somehow the money would be saved. And we've seen, thanks to your work, Madam Chair, that there are the mandates that exist, the statutory mandates, are relatively minor and only amount to pennies. And certainly special education, as you have heard, is the largest mandate, but unfortunately little we can do about it since it comes from the federal government. PERS. We know on July 1st, if the rates are in place, then a 46% increase in the employer contribution rate. If you assume that 85% of our budgets go to payroll, then for every dollar in our budgets, PERS costs will go from 11 to 16 cents. And if you think about PERS just being allocated to salary, that's probably less than a dime for every dollar we spend. So while it's certainly important and we're hopeful that PERS will somehow be resolved, it's still a relatively small amount in the overall scheme of things. Health benefits. I think we're all aware of rising health care costs, and many of those costs are a result of items beyond our control. The average cost, for example, of an average full family medical dental vision plan for school employees went up 850% over the last decade. And anything we can do to resolve health care costs would be of some value. There have been ideas about various kinds of pools, and I would submit that pools already exist. It's a fundamental structural changes that have to be made. Too many administrators. If we could only get rid of administrators, then somehow we could be able to save money. While I know that you want accountability from the agencies that you oversee, the people that I want represent want accountability over the institutions, local institutions that we oversee. And accountability means hiring individuals and putting them in charge and holding them accountable. So I don't think that the idea of somehow eliminating administrators will necessarily save any money.
Mr. Marshall, if I could interject, I don't know if your compatriots wish to make statements, but you're taking a lot of the time we have left here.
I'm finished.
Oh.
I would have yielded, ma'am.
Mr. Rose.
Okay.
All right. Lori, go ahead.
Good morning, committee members. Madam Chair, for the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, representing 45,000 people. And to be brief, I would like to talk about two facts and a little hope. take a little bit different approach today. The two facts I'd like to put on the record are just some points of information that I think really help bring a few things into focus for you that I wanted to put on the record. One is a reminder that according to federal law, the state of Oregon schools in the year 2013 will be required to bring 100% of kids to standards, and if they don't meet the mark, the schools will be punished. So I would plead for some vision with respect to preparing those students to achieve those pretty high goals for in that very near future. The second fact I'd like to bring to your attention is a survey that our offices have done just this week to take a look at all of the contracts that were reopened this year with the purpose of helping the districts balance the budget and what we as the certified personnel alone have done to help Oregon balance its budget in these very critical times. And I wanted to report to you that our total so far is that Oregon teachers have foregone $27 million worth of salary this school year in order to balance the budgets across the 198 school districts. And I thought that was something you would want to know. Now to the hope. Rather than speaking only of the impending crisis, you've heard all, I think, enough about that. I'd like to offer you another approach. I believe that we don't need to turn to blood in the streets. I don't think we need to turn to hopelessness and cuts. I don't think we need to live within these very meager means. There is another way. I've heard legislators kind of shrug with resignation these last couple nights, assuming that any response to new taxes, for example, especially a consumption tax, will be met with a stonewall. And perhaps that particular option would be a tough sell, but we believe there's another proposal that's beginning to gain momentum in this building and that really deserves the attention and time of all 90 legislators and the governor. Rather than insist on a new tax, why not turn to those you already levy but do not collect? We advocate revenue recovery as an alternative to the creation of new taxes for this coming biennium at least. This Ways and Means Committee is the perfect venue to discuss this concept. You all take proposals and look at the numbers and look at programs, whether they're new or whether they're existing programs that you're going to consider appropriating for the future. That is a process that is time-honored and tested in this building. We have no similar model for taking a look at the 350 tax expenditures making $27 billion whole in the future budgets of Oregon. And I believe that it's time for us to have that kind of scrutiny for those to see whether they still satisfy the kinds of public policy purposes for which they were initially enacted. Some of them may very well, and some of them may not. Particularly in desperate times, we believe that perhaps deducting a pleasure boat or a yacht off your taxes may not be quite the highest priority of the state of Oregon to allow. And there may be other ways to look at that. As chair of the Oregon Revenue Coalition, I'm here to tell you that very soon everybody in the building will be getting a copy of this report that we've put together that proposes humbly a process by which the Oregon legislature could take a look at those 350 tax expenditures, and we believe that there's well over $1 billion, modestly speaking, to be harvested from taxes we already levy but do not collect. That may very well help us close the budget hole and deliver a better budget for all of Oregon, including K-12. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Rose.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I have more integrity than it's been suggested by some of the previous speakers. This has been very difficult testimony for me to prepare. I've changed it 40 times in the last 3 days. And I am appreciative of the problem that you face. But the facts are, you heard us about 6 or 8 districts talk, and I've got lists of about 40 emails and response stuff I put out. And by and large, the kind of numbers we're talking about mean 15 to 25% reduction in teacher staffs over the next year and 2 years. And those are program hits, that's too bad, et cetera. There are also significant economic hits in small in communities, and it's proportional. Portland has a list, and you take theirs, and then you go to Conan. Conan has 17 teachers that cut 4 next year and 3 the following year, so they have 10 for their entire school. And you heard the testimony of somebody earlier cutting down to 11 at Crestwell. That is not a school system. By the way, the man said, oh, we've cut our electives, physics and calculus. I never knew physics and calculus was an elective. It was when I was in school. It was offered every other year, and the college-bound guys and gals arranged to take it. But in our society, physics and calculus aren't electives if you're going to be a highly productive person in our kind of economy. Now, having said all that, and you've heard it, and I know that isn't helpful to you, you've got the challenge, the rocks in your pocket, the balls in your court, and you really only have two choices in my view. And when I say you, I'm not talking to the six of you. I'm talking to the 90 of you. We have to address this issue, and the issue is, and Scherzinger did a really good job, the issue is a connection between what we're asking to do and what we're willing to raise to do it. They don't connect. And we have to decide whether we're going to continue to ignore the fact they don't connect. And my view is that you as a group, as individuals and as a group of 90 folks, are going to make one of two choices. You're either going to build and sell to your constituents an Oregon of diminished services and programs. And we can do that. You can take the quality ed model or any other thing and decide our school should be this. And if that's what it should be, we'll have to live with it. But you've got to sell it. And I don't think you can sell that to the people of Oregon. Or you have to build a bridge to a future Oregon that is different than that, and you have to sell that. And that's the challenge you have, whether it's the Revenue Committee or the Ways and Means Committee. And our effort at the measure we just did in January, whether it was a good or bad idea, I don't know. It was the idea we chose to Session 5, and then a third of our legislators went out and campaigned against it. Why would the public have any reason to believe it was the right thing to do? And all I'm asking for is whatever you choose to do, and I have a lot of respect for the process. I've been here a long time, as you know. I'm not unlike that lady last night, unfortunately. Whatever we decide to do, do it. And you all take responsibility for it and go sell it. You can't keep saying we can't do anything and it's somebody else's problem. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. We appreciate your comments, and we appreciate the contribution that you make in the building, too. I have no more people signed up for public testimony. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 5016. The only... you have an announcement for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yesterday we talked about a report, the cost of operating small schools in Oregon, and I did say I'd get it back here, so I just wanted to distribute it today.
Thank you. I would remind the committee that when we reconvene at 8:30 on Monday morning, we will be having a public hearing on the capital construction portion of the higher education budget. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.
Long weekend.